This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we call the show Main Street because this is a show just like Main Streets across the state. It is a place where we gather, we greet our friends, we talk about what's going on, we talk about the weather, maybe we talk about work. A type of work around here that is awfully big business is agriculture. There are 1.8 million cattle and calves in North Dakota, 2.6 million cattle and calves in Montana. That comes down to more than two for every person in each of those states. The proportion of land in farms and ranches in Montana, 64% of the land there set aside for farms and ranches. And today we are going to talk about ranching, threats to ranching, and managing those threats. And my guest is someone who's been studying that from both sides here. Writer Christina Johnson produced a piece in collaboration with ENSIA, a nonprofit magazine focusing on environmental challenges and solutions, and with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit investigative news organization focusing on food, ag, and environmental health. Christina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Your article is on ranchers, cattle, predators. What drew you to writing on this topic?
Well, I live in Montana, and I think there's a lot of conversation about cattle and ranchers across the United States, and I think especially environmental groups, they get a pretty bad rap sometimes. And so I was really drawn to these ranchers trying to do well by both their cows and the landscape and also wildlife and specifically predators, which are certainly controversial across the West.
What do you mean when you say the conservationists are getting a bad rap?
Not the conservationists, but ranchers and ranching, I think, especially in environmental circles, it can be controversial. You know, there's a lot of environmentalists that think that, you know, all ranchers are maybe hurting the land or adding to climate change or, you know, that there's not a place for ranching in conservation. And I think when you're out on some of these ranches and you see how much these ranchers care about their land and what stewards they are for the landscape, I think there's an argument against that.
So there's a lot more of an overlap between environmentalists, conservationists, ranchers, farmers, even hunters can be thrown into that mix.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Your article is on predator coexistence. What does that term mean?
It means really the art of living with predators when you are a livestock operator. So these ranchers are invested in not just their cows, but in the wolves and the bears that exist on this land. And the area where I was focusing is some of the most dense grizzly territory in the lower 48. So it's not a large space. It's the Tom Miner Basin, which is south of Bozeman, Montana. And yet they have maybe 40 grizzly bears, adult grizzly bears, that live really in sort of a five-ranch area. And so these ranchers are really devoted to making sure that they're sharing that space, which can be, you know, it's difficult. It's a challenge for them. But they found really interesting ways that are making it, they're becoming better ranchers even as they try to protect these bears and wolves.
In what ways? What are their techniques that they're doing?
So the biggest thing that I focused on in the story was, I guess the two main large ones are range riding, which is, you know, it's this very sort of classic idea of actually going out and being with your cows, which sounds like something you would think that every rancher does, but on really large industrial ranches today, it's actually pretty uncommon for the rancher to spend a lot of time out there with the cows. They're generally encouraged to be scattered across the land, and the rancher might not go out unless he needs to or she needs to. And instead, what these ranchers are practicing is being out there on horseback with the cows every day. So the Tom Miner Basin Association hires a couple range riders every summer. And they wake up in the morning early before the sun gets up, and they go out and they work with the herd. And they're really training the cows to bunch up the way that bison do and to protect their young from predators, which is something we've really bred out of cows today. And so most cows, the mother isn't going to go and find her baby if there's a threat. And so these range riders work with the cows to practice doing that. And they use a whole set of techniques called low-stress livestock handling, which is where they gently train these animals rather than using hot shots or screaming at them or aggressively moving them. They instead try to tap into the ways the animals naturally think, and they use these sort of zigzag motions and gentle techniques to train the mothers to bunch up with their young again.
You said that this has kind of been bred out of cattle, in particular cows, of course, the females. Why has this been happening? What are we breeding for when we end up probably inadvertently creating a cow that isn't able to protect its calf?
Yeah, we're breeding for a really docile mother, because it can be, you know, if you're the cowhand working with an animal, it can be pretty annoying and maybe beyond annoying, a little bit dangerous to have a mother that might charge you if you start to move toward her calf. So instead, we've bred mothers that kind of don't really have that instinct, and unfortunately, that means they don't have the instinct when a bear is in the area to go look for their calf and stand guard. In part was because for a while we'd really hunted out predators from the landscape, and so predators weren't a main issue. And now that they've been reintroduced and we're starting to see their numbers grow, that has again become a problem.
Yeah, what is the state of some of the primary predators in that area?
So we're seeing, I'll just speak for Montana, the predators that are affecting this area that I was looking at, which is really close to Yellowstone, it pretty much borders Yellowstone National Park. So as wolves were introduced and they started to expand out of the park, they started to, you know, they don't necessarily respect the park borders, and so they're moving into places like the Tom Minor Basin, where my story was focused. And bears have always been in the Tom Minor Basin, but they're increasing in number, and so it's more and more common for a rancher or a landowner in that area to run across them. But the ranchers I talked with, you know, well, the one family I focused on, they've been in that area for generations. And when the kids were growing up, they never saw wolves. They saw coyotes. And then as the kids got to be adults, they started to watch those wolves come over the hills from Yellowstone and into the area. So in some ways, these challenges they're very ancient and they're very new at the same time.
How likely is a wolf or a bear to go after livestock versus some of their other prey animals?
It's actually not their primary or their preferred food. I would say they'll do it if it's easy, and part of the challenge then is making it less convenient, and that is about the same techniques we've been talking about with training your animals to guard their young, and some other things like electric fencing. But they'll do it if it's easy, and yet there are also many animals, many wolves and bears that will totally walk through. I heard stories, especially about grizzlies, that would walk through a herd of cattle, and they're not even going to approach the cows. They have other foods they're interested in. In Tom Minor, there's a root that grows. It's called the caraway root, and the bears love it. So they'll happily dig in a field full of cows eating caraway before they'll attack a calf.
Running a beef or dairy operation is no small expense to farmers and ranchers. And when you were talking about putting in extra measures like electric fencing or extra personnel to go out and do the range riding program, what sort of expense can this add to ranchers? And is there a program out there that can help them take on this additional expense?
Yeah, it's definitely not cheap. I mean, when you talk about range riders, you're talking about a whole other salary or potentially providing room and board for someone. In the Tom Minor Basin, they have funded those positions largely through grants and nonprofit donations. So they've gathered together as a community, and they share the range riders amongst five different ranches, or not five, but several ranches within the area. But so yeah, there is that expense. I think it would be difficult for many individual ranchers to take that on. So part of the solution might be working in a co-op or a group situation. And then with the electric fences, and then there's also something called fladry, which is basically fences that have these strips of cloth that hang from them. And it sounds really simple and basic, but wolves hate seeing that cloth. And so they will rush away from it if they see it.
Wow.
And so those kinds of things, I think there's nonprofits and there's groups that will help ranchers and farmers find that funding. I can't say specifically, but there's a great group in Montana that works. It's called People and Carnivores. And they, if ranchers are interested, they that would be a great place to look for resources. They also work with ranchers in Wyoming and I think maybe a little bit in Idaho, but they could certainly help ranchers in North Dakota find some resources as well, I bet.
Do you have any sense of farmers and ranchers that you met and just kind of introducing this topic? There's no shortage of industries where people would say, listen, I'm working in this every day. I don't need the government telling me how to do this if this became a law, or I don't need people who aren't farmers and ranchers telling me how to run a farm or a ranch. So how are the people who are advocating these non-lethal methods spreading this message?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, one of the advocates that I spoke with, she works for People and Carnivores, and she said, we don't try to talk people who aren't interested in this in it. Instead, we ask neighbors to spread the news of how effective it's been for them. And so she really finds that it's best for ranchers and farmers to be their own advocates and to tell their neighbors, you know, this year I had zero depredations and this is how I did it, rather than having an outsider come in who, you know, might be chalked up as an environmentalist who's more pro-wolf than they are pro-cow.
Mm. What happens to a predator animal after it kills livestock, assuming we know which animal killed the livestock?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a great question because part of it is assuming we know, and that can be really tricky. You might find an animal that looks like it's been snacked on by a bear, but maybe it died of natural causes before that, mm-hmm. and then the bear came along. So you have to prove, and that's really bringing out Wildlife Services to do an autopsy and figure out that this animal was legitimately killed by a predator. And then in that case, if it's a bear, and it's a grizzly bear, because they spent so long on the endangered species list, and that was just lifted this summer, but they're given a little bit of leeway. So it might not necessarily be the first time they kill an animal that they're euthanized. Because their reproduction rates are so low and because it has taken so long to build their population up, they won't necessarily kill a bear right away if there is a depredation. But if they start to see a pattern and they start to get the sense that this bear genuinely targets cattle, then Wildlife Services will come out and trap the bear, and then it'll be transferred over to one of the state agencies to actually euthanize.
What about wolves, bobcats, other predators in the area?
So wolves definitely are taken out, I think, at a faster clip than bears. I can't necessarily speak to bobcats and other predators, but what they'll do with wolves is if they see, you know, maybe one animal's been attacked by a wolf, they might take out the entire pack. And that's often done, it's kind of aggressive, you know, maybe a plane and fly over and shoot the entire pack. So I think wolves, even if you're not the animal that was implicated in it, you might find that your life is pretty short because of it. So they're more aggressive towards them, I would say.
You did this piece in collaboration with NCIA. This is a nonprofit magazine on environmental challenges and solutions. And then the other partner here, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit investigative news organization focusing on food, ag, and environmental health. How did you get connected with these organizations?
Well, I actually worked as a staff writer for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. And Fern's pretty great because they partner with all sorts of organizations to share stories about food and agriculture, and their goal is to really make sure that these stories are being told across a wide variety of platforms so we can catch as many different types of audiences as possible. And it's not just something that policy wonks or environmentalists in San Francisco or New York are thinking about, but that we're reaching audiences across the country.
Yeah, quite a variety of topics. The websites, the article is on ensia.com, that's ENSIA, and then also at fern.org. Writer Christina Johnson writing an article on predator coexistence that examines non-lethal approaches that some ranchers in Montana are taking to help their livestock deal with predator animals. Christina, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota and the Geminids Meteor Shower.
Support for this program is provided by Great River Energy and its 320 employees who are partnering with North Dakota to help our country meet its growing demands for energy while utilizing new technologies for a cleaner environment.
NPR One is all about
you.
Handpicked public radio content based on what you like.
Who knew?
NPR One connects you to a stream of public radio news, stories, and podcasts curated especially for you.
NPR Hourly Newscasts, Prairie Public Regional News, it's all there.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Download NPR One in the App Store now and select Prairie Public as your station.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
A world of customized content delivered right to your smartphone.
Okay, guys, headphones on.
The story puts you in the center of the action.
It's on whenever you're on.
NPR One is all about
you.
Download it today.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. This week and next, we are in for a treat. Sky watchers say that 2016 could be a fantastic year for the Geminids meteor shower. Here's Chuck Lura with this week's Natural North Dakota.
Time to look up at the heavens at night. The granddaddy of all meteor showers has begun. The Geminids meteor shower runs from December 7th to the 17th, with a peak period coming on evening of Wednesday the 13th and early morning hours of the 14th. The Geminids are known for producing a lot of showy meteors, and with a waning crescent moon during the peak, if the sky is clear, we could be in for an impressive show. The Geminids are known for producing lots of meteors, perhaps up to 120 meteors per hour or even more during the peak period. Plus, these meteors have a reputation of being unusually bright with long trails that persist longer than the other meteor showers. And if we're really lucky, we should be able to see a large meteor called a fireball bust up in the sky to form several smaller meteors. It's hard to believe that most meteors are the size of a grain of sand or so, but they're cruising through space at roughly 30 miles per second. If you do the math, that's 1,800 miles per minute, or 108,000 miles per hour. That's like going from Fargo-Moorhead to Beach in a little under 12 seconds. Most meteor showers are caused by comets. Comets are mixtures of ice, rock, and dust. Think of them as dirty snowballs or snowy dirt balls a few miles in diameter. When they pass near the sun, the heat causes them to slough off small sand-sized particles. When they hit the Earth's atmosphere, they become glowing hot, which from our perspective looks like a falling star. The Geminids are different. Along with the quadranted meteor shower, they're not caused by comets. Rather, these meteors are caused by asteroids. The source of the Geminids was not discovered until the early 1980s. So if you can, and the sky is clear, find a dark location during the peak viewing period, get comfortable, and watch what could be the most impressive celestial show of the year. And if that doesn't work for the peak viewing period, find another time close to the peak viewing period. Better yet, watch them a little bit over several evenings. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Chuck Lura is a biology professor at Dakota College at Bottineau. Coming up next on Main Street, inheritance and the family farm.
Won't you be our neighbor? Prairie Public is partnering with Gate City Bank and Cambrian Credit Union to help keep all of our neighbors warm with the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood Sweater Drive. Now through December 15th, drop off new or gently worn sweaters at any Gate City Bank in North Dakota and Western Minnesota, or any Cambrian Credit Union in Manitoba. Your gift will be distributed to folks in those communities who are in need of a little extra warmth. For more information, visit prairiepublic.org.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor.
Thank you for being a good neighbor.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The hero of the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey, just aches to leave his hometown.
I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
It has been this way for generations, ambitious kids from small towns heading off to big cities and eventually taking their inheritance with them. Hundreds of billions of dollars will pass between generations in the next few decades. And as Frank Morris reports for Harvest Public Media, some rural places are figuring out how to keep a bit of that money at home.
Royal Nebraska here is a dot on the vast corn and soybean fields blanketing the northeastern part of the state. Like a lot of remote towns, it's seen better days. And Colleen Murphy, weathered 57-year-old, leaning on a beat-up old gas pump, says progress may soon finish Royal.
Local people, my generation and older, are still trying to hold things together, but when the kids leave, you can't do anything about it.
And when the young people flee, family money follows. Over in O'Neill, a town of 3,600 in Holt County, Nebraska, lawyer Jan Kratterkwala has seen the same thing.
People come back for the funeral. They live somewhere else. And we basically stop at the bank on the way out of town and send the money away from here, never to be seen again.
We're talking about wealth built over generations, suddenly gone. And Kratterkwala says that for small towns, retaining at least some of that capital can be crucial.
If it moves out of here, you're going to snap your fingers, it's going to be done, it's going to be over, and all you're going to have is empty buildings on your main street. All you're going to have is nobody in your churches and your schools. It's too late.
And she has a pressing question for people planning their estates.
What about making the community one of your heirs along with your children and your other heirs that you have in your estate?
Foundations in Nebraska have been doing this purposefully for years, thanks to leadership from the Nebraska Community Foundation. Its president, Jeff Yost, says the state's charitable funds have been bracing for an enormous generational and geographical handover as baby boomers pass on.
We estimate the transfer of wealth to be some $600 billion over the next 50 years. So it's huge money.
And that's just Nebraska. Dozens of community foundations have sprung up in tiny towns across the Midwest to try to capture some of this money. In Nebraska, small foundations have boosted their holdings by almost fivefold in the last decade. And that's making a big difference in places like Holt County.
Hey, Dan! Come on in!
The community foundation in O'Neill is throwing a coffee this morning. It's part of a fundraising effort it hopes will trigger a matching grant and roughly double the size of its permanent endowment.
And we're happy to say today we're at 96% of our $200,000 goal.
Foundations here are turning that money into all kinds of nice stuff for the community. This meeting is in a new building, a satellite campus for a regional community college built with help from foundation funding. Another foundation helped to bring wind energy, a movie theater, and a brewery out here. Not to mention, it helped to save the ethanol plant and all of those jobs. And the big payoff comes when places like Holt County, Nebraska, foster local businesses and amenities that attract family. Jonna Cole lives in a new house with her husband and four daughters. Tonight, she's giving the baby a bath. Cole grew up here, went away to school, became an optometrist, and then moved back.
I did find a lot of people questioning my decision. You know, you went out, you got your graduate degree, you must be out in the world. What are you doing back here?
And Cole says she sees more people her age doing the same thing, taking jobs here or working remotely.
I do feel things are turning around. I feel very optimistic and hopeful for the future of this area.
An area that is having some success in reversing the decline of rural America. In Holt County, Nebraska, I'm Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration covering America's ag and rural issues. Still to come on Main Street, Eric Dethridge and I have our What's Happening calendar of event, and Chef Rosie dives into food trends to expect in 2018. But now, it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Today I am announcing that in the coming weeks, I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate.
Minnesota Senator Al Franken made that announcement on the Senate floor this morning. Franken still maintained his denial of some of the sexual misconduct accusations against him and said he remembers some of the incidents differently than his accusers. He said he wanted the Senate Ethics Committee to thoroughly investigate the accusations.
But Minnesotans deserve a senator who can focus with all her energy on addressing the challenges they face every day.
This comes on the heels of most of the Democratic women senators, including North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp, urging him to resign. In a statement, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton says he has not decided who to appoint to take Franken's place until a special election is held in 2018. Some speculation has centered around Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, and there have been a number of other names suggested. A new government report out today says workers at meat and poultry processing plants may not get the necessary protections on the job. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports.
The report by the Government Accountability Office says workers may avoid reporting safety problems to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration because they fear retaliation from their employer. One main concern detailed in the report is that workers say OSHA is not aware of the scope of the problem of bathroom access. Workers say meat company supervisors won't allow for bathroom breaks from the processing lines. This report follows a 2016 GAO study that said even though meatpacking has the highest injury rate of any industry, those problems are still underreported. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
And North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp is sticking by her decision to oppose the tax cut bill the Senate approved on a 51-49 vote. Heitkamp says the bill's supporters claim it's aimed at cutting taxes for the middle class, but she says most economists agree the bill actually favors the wealthiest. Heitkamp says for anyone earning $75,000 a year, the tax cut amounts to about $200, and she says after the year 2025, the middle class will see their taxes going up.
I would just recommend that people, you know, if people say, well, I still, you know, it's still nice to get a little something. Just remember that little something that you're getting is very small in comparison to what the wealthiest are getting. And that little something that you're getting, guess what you're doing to get it? You're handing your children $1 trillion credit card debt. I just don't think it's the right bargain.
The bill is now in a House and Senate conference committee, and the Senate will get another bite at the apple later. Heitkamp says she and some of her colleagues tried to get the bill back into committee through some procedural votes, but those failed. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. So many of our debates today have to do with science, climate change, GMOs, alternative energy. We think about the effects our answers have on our lives and the world, but not our politics. On the next Why Radio, we'll change that. Join me and my guest, Heather Douglas, for a conversation we're calling What Does Science Policy Have to Do with Democracy? On the next Why Radio, Sunday, December 10th at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and once a week, Chef Rosie from Rosie's Bistro joins us to talk about food. And as we're ending 2017 and starting on 2018, if you like Chef Rosie, you're looking at food trends. So, Rosie, what's coming down the pipeline?
You know, it's always interesting when we talk about food trends because as we get older, we start to realize that those come in a big circle because we think that, oh, these are hot new trends for 2018. But I've been doing trends writings for over 30 years that I've had knowledge of it and more than 40 years that I've been cooking it. But we as young chefs always thought we were doing something new and creative and nobody's done this before. But the older you get, you realize it's just a big circle.
Well, my grandparents
it's spinning.
Did this.
It's spinning and it's coming around. But these are trends and these are not Tim's. These are not Rosie's trends. These are trends that are a combination of lots of trade magazines and trade organizations and the best cooking schools in the world. And all I've done is compile a list of some things that they think that well, they don't – not they think. These are all surveys and these are all documented. So these are all items that are going to happen in our country.
Well, let me ask you this. Before we even start listing trends, do they tend to be more chef-driven or consumer-driven?
Oh, most of these trends, well, I say they're both because we as chefs like to think that we create the new trend.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, it's our customer. We report to our guests. Report to our guests. And we moms report to their children, you know, because we have
Tell
to.
Me about
we're
it.
Cooking new. The way mom cooks today is way different than what grandma made. But then again, when I think back, grandma picked vegetables from the garden and she canned from the garden and she canned fruits from the trees and she canned. So that's a lot of what's coming back around. So right. I would say it's a combination of both.
Okay. So what are some of these trends?
Okay. The first one I have on my list is the new utilization of meat, grains, and fruit byproducts. Wow. What in the heck does that mean? Very simply put, something as simple as the meat chart that we've been using to break down the three primary animals of beef, pork, and lamb. We've used the same charts for decades, and those charts show you how to break down an animal. And there are many other ways to break down that animal. There are lots of other little parts in that animal, including the offal. And I always thought that the offal was just the internal organs, the kidneys and the livers and the heart and all those things. But now I've come to learn that offal is also in the Midwest. How many hundreds of beer breweries do we have now between Minneapolis and Duluth and Fargo? There's just hundreds of them. And all of them toast and roast grains to make their beer. And when after they toast that grain, they have something that is a byproduct, and that is called the offal. And the offal is something that for years went out the back door and into the garbage can and didn't have many uses. Well, we're starting to find a lot of uses. And the first one I brought up is beer, and that's the spent hull, the roasted spent grain husk. And now we use that more than just making dog bones. We dry that and we make it. We utilize it as a percentage of flour in our breads. We use it for the texture. We use it for the flavor. We use it for the volume. But why should we be throwing away all of that wheat and barley and hops? And even though it's been cooked, even though some of the flavor and some of the nutrition has been taken out of it, there's no doubt about that. It's not as healthy as when we picked it
as
the first time around.
Okay.
But it's the utilization of that in cooking.
The concept of roasting the chicken and then using the bones to make
a stock. Exactly. And the same thing holds true with the grapes in California, the grapes to make wine, all of those skin that we've used, that we press the grape, we make the wine, we sell the wine for hundreds of dollars a bottle. It's wonderful. But the skins, for years, they weren't used for anything at all. If you went to wineries in whatever state you live in, you could find those out back, and those were just covered with flies, and they were on their way to the garbage can, or sometimes to be used as compost, and that's certainly a way to utilize the process. But now we use them in food. We use that skin of the grape, and we use it to make vinegars. We use it to make ice creams. We use it to make jams and jellies. We use it to make briquettes of Cabernet Sauvignon grape skin dried and packed into briquettes. So now we're smoking our salmon over Cabernet Sauvignon grape briquettes from California.
Are you just reading your Christmas list on the air? These are all the things I want for Christmas.
You know, and it's pretty amazing because we're just basically utilizing – I guess just gave you an example earlier when I roasted a hog in South Florida when the Cubans ate the hog. There was nothing left on the table or nothing left but the squeal because the Latinos know how to eat the entire hog.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the jowls and that's the snout and that's the eyes and the ears and the tail. And we as Americans, Midwest Americans, we like the ribs, we like the ham, we like the bacon. But the jowl and the head and the ears and the cheeks will all be left on the table.
Well, and using the whole animal, something very much an indigenous style cooking or back to sort of the prairie settling areas, and then it disappeared for a long time. So yeah, this trend is let's go back 200 years and do it how they were doing it.
Just think of we always in every town I've lived in or been to, there's always butcher shops. When you went to a butcher shop, you could see the butchers breaking down sides of lamb and sides of pork, and you saw the whole animal hanging. Well, we don't ship like that anymore because it costs money to ship bones and we don't get money for bones. But now we're realizing we always have known that when you leave the bone on cuts of meat, you get a much more flavorful, wholesome piece of meat. So now we're starting when the butchers are breaking down and we're seeing in major cities, we're seeing butcher shops that are just pork and just lamb and just beef. And they're bringing in sides of beef. But it's not just a side of beef anymore. It's a side of beef from Ashley Thornburg's ranch, and it was raised on dandelion flowers, and it was organic, and it was natural, and it was grass-fed, and it was – so now that hanging animal has a – and it might have had a name, by the way.
Yeah, throw in a couple goats, maybe a monkey and a unicorn, and that sounds exactly like the kind of farm I would have.
Exactly. So all of a sudden now we're taking this animal and it's – we're utilizing all of the animal, and we're leaving some of the bone on a bone-in filet mignon. Perfect example. We've known filet mignon my whole life and many generations. It's a boneless, it's the most tender piece of meat on an animal, but it's also the least flavorful.
Yeah.
But when you leave the bone on
it,
as we're doing now, and we lard it with bacon or lard it with pork fat, we get a much better product. So understanding when you go to the butcher shop, seeing the guy in the white coat with the gloves and the white hat on in the back, breaking down, and it's to his advantage to utilize as much of that animal. And it's those different cuts of meat too. I mean, something as simple as the tri-tip or the hanger steak or the A-cut prime, it's just taking making different cuts of the same animal that we've been slaughtering for years.
All right, you've got another trend on your list here, house-made condiments. So we're talking about when you go to a restaurant, they're not just making the food, they're making the ingredients they use to make the food then, right?
Exactly. You know, when I think of house-made condiments, I think of, well, you know, we as restaurateurs and chefs and moms and grandmas, we always think we make homemade in our house. Well, why is it when I look in your refrigerator, I find American Kraft mustard, and I find Hunt's and Heinz ketchup, and I find Hellman's mayonnaise, and I find Publix ice cream, and I find Skippy peanut butter, and I find, wow, so those are okay all of a sudden. Mm. And they're so simple to make. So something as simple as, and I'll tell you, mustard for an example. You can go to your local spice market, probably not your local grocery store, because there you'll find mustard seed of one variety and you won't know where it came from or when it was harvested. But go to a spice store and you'll find Chinese mustard and Italian mustard, and you'll find mustard seeds, and you'll find mustard sprouts, and you'll find mustard greens. Mm-hmm. But all that make wonderful mustards that are so easy to make and last for so long in your refrigerator that you will never have some brand's name of yellow mustard in your refrigerator again, because once you make it, and that's the same thing holds true for ketchup. And the same thing holds true for mayonnaise. I'm not going to push too hard on, because there is
mayonnaise is easy.
It's easy to make, but it's also the most dangerous thing to make, because we're using egg yolks and we're putting it in the refrigerator. And let's just check the mayonnaise in your refrigerator, Ashley. How long has it been there?
Well, mayo does not last very long in my family because we eat it a lot.
You know, it's funny because mayonnaise is one of the things that can sit in the refrigerator for days, weeks, months, years, and it sits in there. And if you start making homemade mayonnaise, that's not an option.
No, you got a week maybe.
Yeah, and that's only if you use sanitized utensils making it and you followed proper. Mayonnaise is something that in the restaurant business, mayonnaise, hollandaise, béarnaise, I mean the rule in the restaurant business in sanitation guides, 90 minutes. 90 minutes we have to make it new. So don't mess around
with
that.
Well, and it doesn't sound like you need too many special tools for this at all. Maybe peanut butters, you want to invest in a good food processor or a blender. But other than that, it's all stuff you have at home.
But toasted peanuts, Spanish peanuts, all the different varieties. And making, you know, once you make it homemade, you go, wow, this is not Skippy. This is not Jif. This is homemade. And something that's even... You know, we just talked about ice cream. God knows we can go to the store and buy ice cream. We can buy many different flavors and different price points. We can pay $5 for a cup or $5 for 2 gallons, and we get those different levels. But just make ice cream at home one time and roast pecans. Yeah, and you'll just have something totally different.
All right, you've got another trend on here, ethnic-inspired breakfast items. I am all about this trend.
You know, that one I'm just going to jump on a little bit, but boy, isn't it amazing how in every country you travel to or every country you read about, that one used to be my favorite thing of Gourmet Magazine, because every month it was a different country they featured. So that was the fun part. I could travel there and never leave Fargo. I could be in Peru and eat a quinoa bowl. Who knew what quinoa was? And now, you know, 20 years ago, quinoa, that would have been a foreign word that meant nothing to most of this part of the world, North America for sure. Mm-hmm. And yet it's one of the most ancient Aztec, Inca, flavorful and healthy grains in the world.
So kind of using it like an oatmeal? Or
yes,
how
using
we,
it as an oatmeal, but use it in breakfast just like we would oats, whether we add butter or milk or maple or whatever. But even something like arancini from Italy, which is nothing but a rice ball, but not Uncle Ben's rice. It's an Italian rice, an arborio rice, or a good high mountain rice, and then putting mozzarella cheese or fresh mozz on the inside and making a ball and rolling it in breadcrumbs and frying it, and wonderful, wonderful. Or my favorite, after living in South Florida for so many years, arepas. I mean, arepas are nothing but a corn cake. While we make pancakes, corn cakes aren't a heck of a lot different.
I love cornmeal pancakes.
Yes, well, making them with not just cornmeal.
Real corn.
It's back to... Is it dry corn? Is it sweet corn? Is it field corn? Is it And then it's the type of corn we use and how we put it together. We make a corn pancake, mm-hmm. and we put a pocket in the middle of it. And then in that pocket, we can put queso blanco if we're in Venezuela or Colombia. We can put Norwegian cheese, Jotost or Bremost, in the middle of it to give it a little bit of a Scandinavian flavor. But there again, we're taking something healthy, such as the cornmeal or the quinoa, and turn it into breakfast, the banh mi sandwich. 10 years ago, I never knew what that was, and now I can find it in almost most delis, most sandwich shops. And where did that come from? Where did those two words come from? But all of a sudden, that's an ethnic-inspired dish. That's a street food dish, and we've taken it in lots of different directions, and we've made it more healthy as well.
All right, well, we are out of time. You've got about 20 more things on the food list, so we're going to pick up food trends for 2018 again next week. Rosie, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
What's happening is next.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street. This week, I chat with Massimo Bottura, chef patron at Osteria Francescana. He organized many of the world's top chefs to open the world's best soup kitchen in Milan. Also up this week, we investigate a food disorder that leads people to take up very strange diets, and Adam Gopnik has some opinions on what his son is drinking as a barman in Baltimore. Coming up this week on Mill Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And what a great question that is. What's going on? Every week we seek to answer that question with our What's Happening calendar of events. Eric Dethridge is my special guest to go through this week's calendar. Eric, thanks for being here with us.
Pleasure, Ashley. And I think everybody's getting in that holiday spirit, and you can celebrate a Prairie holiday story with children's book author Roxanne Solonen at the Fargo Main Library downtown on Tuesday. Now, her latest book, The 12 Days of Christmas in North Dakota, features 12 days of lefse. No, but that wouldn't be a bad thing, right? But you can learn more about the book's creation and munch on some seasonal treats like lefse. This kid-friendly and free event gets going at 6:30 p.m. It's more than just lefse. Check it out at the library downtown.
Where's the Roma Grove? Come on here.
I got lefse on the brain. I got lefse on the mind. Actually, what could I say? Tuesday at the downtown library in Fargo, 6:30 p.m.
There is a Heritage Christmas Festival this Saturday, the 9th, in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. They have food, Mr. and Mrs. Claus, lots of gift, baked goods, holiday music. Just some of the great features going on again at the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby. There is even going to be a roast beef dinner. Santa and Mrs. Claus walking around greeting the kids after 5 p.m. Caroling at 6:30, and that caroling you can join in, and there will also be singers who are trained singers, youth from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints doing that caroling. Get started at 5 o'clock Saturday the 9th in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. Is $10 for adults and $5 for kids 6 to 12, less than 6, no charge.
Well, can you imagine what it's like to be a young adult and trying to
make
humor?
No, I have no idea what that's like.
I forgot. It's been years. But, man, just immerse yourself in the dating scene, the online dating scene in New York City, just trying to make a human connection. Well, you don't have to imagine that anymore. You can find out as Minot State University campus players present Laugh Out Loud, Cry Quietly at the Aleshire Theater on campus, 7:30 p.m. tonight through Saturday. Now, this play, conceived by MSU student Maddie Thompson, is a benefit for the group putting it on, the campus players, in their upcoming trip to a theater fest in Iowa. Tickets are $5 to $7. Laugh Out Loud, Cry Quietly at MSU tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday.
Bizman Big Band, Sunday the 10th in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. The Bismarck Mandan Big Band presenting a free concert with music from lots of different big bands of the past with some of the region's finest musicians and music educators. Styles here include swing, Latin rock, contemporary, and timeless jazz, alongside those great big band numbers. 2 o'clock Sunday the 10th in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum, and it's free.
And you can get into the holiday spirit, too, in Williston on Sunday at the Fort Buford State Historic Site for Christmas at the confluence of the Yellowstone and Missouri Rivers, in case you didn't know. There will be crafts, refreshments, plenty of music from Tuba Christmas, the Lizen Bees, Arch Elwine, plus the very busy couple to get around these days, Mr. and Mrs. Claus. They're going to make a pit stop there. The free festivities get going at 1:30 p.m. and run till 5 Christmas at the Confluence Sunday at Fort Buford in Williston.
The 17th Annual Cookie Walk this Saturday the 9th in Bismarck on Front Avenue. Do all your holiday baking without actually having to make a mess or do too much work here, as the Bismarck Art and Galleries Association doing their 17th Annual Cookie Walk. Again, Saturday the 9th gets going at 10 a.m. and goes until 3 p.m. or until the cookies are gone. More than 200 dozen homemade holiday cookies, candies, and treats are for sale. And again, it goes until 3 p.m. or until all of those treats are gone. Starts at 10 a.m. The cost is however much you want to pay for cookies.
Well, I know a certain monster on PBS that doesn't usually pay anything for that. Well, how does this sound, Ashley? A Sunday brunch featuring Christmas dishes from Scandinavia and Germans from Russia. All right, sounds like pretty much any dinner table in North Dakota, but it all comes together at A Taste of Ethnic Christmas in Medora at the Chateau de Mor Interpretive Center from 10:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's being held in conjunction with Medora's Old Fashioned Cowboy Christmas. $15 for adults, $5 for kids 6 to 12, and under 6 is free.
The Fargo-Moorhead Gay Men's Chorus presenting A Shining Night Sunday the 10th in Fargo at the Sanctuary Arts Center. You're going to be singing secular tunes, Christmas carols, Hanukkah songs, even music from an Eastern Orthodox traditions here. God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen to Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies, 7 p.m. Sunday the 10th in Fargo at the Sanctuary Event Center, and tickets are $15.
All right, Christmas curmudgeons and Scrooges. This ought to make a believer out of you. The timeless tale Miracle on 34th Street, the play, is happening in Williston at the Old Armory Theater tonight through Monday with a Sunday matinee. Kris Kringle, a department store Santa, who of course is the real Santa, has to prove it in court. Bring the entire family to this heartwarming take on the classic film Miracle on 34th Street in Williston at the Armory Theater.
All right, my event of the week is that the Geminids meteor shower is happening. It gets going tonight. It's supposed to peak right around Wednesday, Thursday of next week. Get outside, get a blanket, put on your, you know, cuddle duds and your thermal underwear and whatever you need. Pour some cocoa. The Geminids meteor shower, one of the very few meteor showers where you can see it during somewhat normal hours, but it does peak usually around 2 o'clock in the morning. So if you can stay up or get up, go check out the Geminids.
Warm clothing required, probably, no doubt. Minot and Grand Forks, two cities that share a fairly recent history of devastating floods, they come together as the North Dakota Museum of Art features a book launch for Codex. That's a book that focused on the fate of damaged books in the aftermath of the 2011 Minot flood. There's going to be a roundtable discussion with three of his collaborators happening at the Museum of Art in Grand Forks tomorrow at 3 p.m.
All right. Well, thanks, Eric. Appreciate it. That's what's happening.
I saw the New York City skyline and I thought, that's New York City, man. There's crazy stuff going on there. And in some small way, it can't happen without somebody like me, a cab driver. And then I actually said out loud, I belong here.
Join us for more true stories told live next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for December 7th. Fargo's history of fires is largely dominated by the Fire of 1893, which ravaged the wooden buildings that filled the city's downtown. But the city's fire legacy goes back much further. In 1875, at Fargo's first government meeting, the city's mayor and aldermen appointed two fire wardens to patrol the city. Bucket brigades fought fires in those early years. A fire ordinance in 1877 set the stage for a volunteer fire department, the Pioneer Fire Company, led by a chief engineer and equipped with the city's first hook and ladder fire rig. But the company wasn't officially organized or chartered until 1880, when it became the Continental Hose Company No. 1. Hose Company No. 2 followed 2 years later. On this date in 1883, the Yerxa Hose Company No. 3 was established, named after Fargo Mayor Woodford Yerxa. Local businessmen comprised the company, which was called the most dedicated and effective of Fargo's volunteer fire companies. Volunteer firefighters served Fargo until 1903, when the city opted for a paid professional department. The first professional fire chief was appointed from Continental Hose Company No. 1. By 1904, the department had 10 professionals who earned $60 a month, on duty 24/7, with on- and off-duty shifts to come in later years. The firefighters used horse-drawn rigs until 1919. By 1904, the city no longer had volunteer firefighters, though many North Dakota towns still do, and sorely need more. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Prairie Public Education Services is hosting a series of free professional development workshops featuring area teachers, PBS resources, and best tech tips. Interactive sessions for every grade level and content area happening weekly. Join in person at the Prairie Public Station in Fargo or join virtually via webinar. Go to prairiepublic.education.org for more information and to sign up.
Mississippi was a key battleground in the nation's struggle for civil rights. But the state has been slow to acknowledge its violent, racist past. Now a new state-funded museum will tell the story.
We lived it, and some of them died with it. The rest of Mississippi needs to know about it.
A tour of the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum with the family of a civil rights martyr on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we visit with Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the philosopher and host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. The show airs this coming Sunday on Prairie Public, and he is going to be visiting with Heather Douglas as they have a conversation, What Does Science Policy Have to Do with Democracy? Jack joins us for a preview of that episode of Why. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.